This is the State of Things broadcasting from the American Tobacco Historic District. I'm Frank Stasio. From Whalebone Junction down to North River Bridge, Outer Banks communities share a landscape and a way of life. Barbara Garrity Blake is a cultural anthropologist. She spent years collecting oral histories there. She teamed up with Karen Willis Amspacker, the director of the Core Sound Waterfall Museum and Heritage Center on Harkers Island. And together they wrote something that's part guidebook and part preservation effort. Living at Water's Edge, a heritage guide to the Outer Banks Byway, takes readers on a journey that reveals the unique culture and the history of these island communities and also the changes that lap at their shores even today. Karen and Barbara are going to read from their books at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh tomorrow. They're going to be at the Regulator Bookshop in Durham on Thursday and at Core Sound Waterfall Museum and Heritage Center next month. But right now they're here in the studio. Welcome to the State of Things. Good to have you here.
Thank you, Frank.
Good to be here.
It's nice to have you back. Barbara, tell us about your work, the work that you were doing at the Outer Banks that led to this project.
Sure. I was working on an ethnohistorical study for the Park Service for actually both Cape Hatteras and Cape Lookout. And that entailed going through older oral histories that they had on file, which were wonderful, collected in the 60s and 70s and 80s, and collecting new oral histories. So we had a team of researchers, and we just went into all the nooks and crannies along the Outer Banks and down east, did a lot of really wonderful recordings, and I realized, you know, although I've lived in the area for 30 years and I thought I knew all there was to know, I didn't know anything. There was so much I learned. So it's just a wonderful experience.
And then talk about putting this together, because you actually follow the Outer Banks Byway, which maybe you can tell us about that, and then the idea of sort of collecting these stories and creating this book.
Right, yeah. So as in your introduction, the Byway runs from Whalebone Junction, which is just north of Hatteras Island. And it goes south through all the villages on Hatteras, then, of course, the ferry to Ocracoke, then the ferry to Down East, and winds its way along the 13 communities of Down East. So that was established about 5 years ago, the national...
2009.
Thank you, Karen. Karen is our date person.
Well, and also you maybe give us a sense of the culture and what characterizes the people who live along that byway, would you say, Karen?
The one word is
you can use five.
The one word is hard work.
Yeah.
Weathered. I think they're very honest, very close to the earth. Very basic, but strong and proud.
Well, it might lead to questions about how you can ask people to contribute stories, because there are ways in which people who live in close-knit communities like that don't always. I mean, you're not an outsider, but if you come from somewhere else saying you got this project, they may not be so willing to help. What kind of support did you get for this?
Well, you know, most of what we pulled from had already been recorded. So, you know, I too have been collecting oral histories and bringing in people to collect histories. And it's a mixed bag, because sometimes if you're part of the story, it's harder to interview someone than it is if you don't know anything. And Barbara and I do workshops for oral history collecting. We tell people the less you know, the better, because then you can ask all the basic questions. If I'm going to sit down and talk to somebody about boat building, I'm not going to start with bow and stern. I'm going to start calling names. Yeah. So
Barbara, what kind of questions were you asking?
Well, for the Park Service, the primary focus for the Cape Hatteras project was life before the bridge. And, you know, the bridge was in the roads, came in the late 60s, early 70s. And so, you know, there has been a perception that the Outer Banks were places of great isolation. And in fact, one of the grant proposals that I read for an earlier oral history project said, these are unique people isolated for years with their strange customs, you know, in so many words. But when you really sit down and talk to people, you realize that there was quite a worldliness of the folks back then, because they were attached by the water. And, you know, the waterways were the highway. And so, sure, in some ways, Ocracoke and Hatteras, and then, you know, earlier Shackelford Banks and Cape Lookout were isolated. And yet people worked on vessels that went out to the West Indies. They went all the way up the Atlantic seaboard. In fact, I live in a little town called Gloucester. And there was a man actually related to my neighbor, the Pigots, Josephus Pigott, who had a cargo schooner called the Charmer, and he ran that regularly up to Gloucester. So when the post offices came in and communities had to come up with a name that didn't, you know, wasn't redundant to another name, he said, you know what, I love this town of Gloucester in Massachusetts, let's call our town Gloucester. So that shows that connection was so tight.
And also when you're collecting these stories, again, I know that some of them were already on record, but how many, to what extent do you find people who love to tell stories? Here I'm thinking about James Allen Rose on Harker's Island, who is revered as and renowned as a storyteller. To what extent do you, Karen, do you sort of rely on people like that for a project like this?
James Allen is, you just turn the switch and it goes, and you just have, you run out of tape and you go home. James Allen's life was a story. You didn't have to have a microphone there. His conversation was story-based, and because that's what he had lived, and that's the kind of people I grew up around. I didn't realize that was storytelling. I thought that was just talking.
Tell us more about him.
James Allen?
Yeah.
James Allen was everything. He was a boat builder by trade, but like a lot of other Harker's Island boat builders, he could sing, he could play music, and he lived the stories, and a great historian. Barbara was talking about isolation and the perception that banks-based people were kind of, you know, in a world of their own. I can tell you name after name of people who were so well-read. My great-uncle, who was born in the 1800s, knew things that I will never know, even with an internet, because he read. They were readers. And James Allen was a reader and recorded much of his own history and kept up with the dates. And, I mean, I was never with him that I didn't learn something. And we miss him terribly.
Music also very important, as Karen suggested, Barbara. And, in fact, I read in your book that somebody thinks that almost every house in Portsmouth has had an organ at one time, or maybe still does, right? Is that true?
I've heard that. What do you think, Karen? Would you
agree? The organs were prevalent. The only organ on Portsmouth right now is the one in the church.
Mm-hmm.
But yes, organs were throughout. And I don't know why, because there was an organ like at the Berkeley Center in Ocracoke.
Apparently they were $35 at Sears and Roebuck. And
yeah,
that was
well, but $35 was hard to come by,
yeah.
Buddy.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that was a whole, I don't know how they did it. And music and fiddles, you know, we're getting ready actually to do a big fiddle project with Ivy Scott, who's mentioned in the book,
right.
Who was a fiddle player that made the Bougeot Run Ashore story and song so famous for Harker's Island. But people had good lives. They were small lives, but they were rich and smart people.
Rich in tradition. An old Christmas tradition stood out to all of you because it's in the book. On Hatteras Island, give us a sense of what that was and why that was so important.
Yeah, right. I mean, that it's not a was, it's an is. Yeah. And that's the community of Rodanthe. They have held Old Christmas, which is the old 12th night tradition of celebrating, basically, they say two Christmases. But on January 5th, that's changed over the years, where now they have it on the, you know, the closest Saturday to January 5th. But it's a wonderful thing. I've been to a couple of the old Christmases, and they cook chicken and pastry. They have an oyster shoot out back where people test their marksmanship. Back in the day, it was the Coast Guardsmen that would have these marksmanship displays. They used to have parades where people would be in costume that morning very early, and it would lead to this, you know, celebration and a big feast. They still have the big feast, but the highlight of Old Christmas in Rodanthe is the mythical bull that's trotted out at the magical moment, and that's Old Buck. So there's a whole legend attached to Old Buck that he was shipwrecked on Hatteras Island and disappeared into Trent Woods, but was a very virile bull who helped populate the island with more cattle. But he comes out at every old Christmas, and the kids touch Old Buck for good luck.
You know, Karen, we've been talking about it, and you've commented on this, that if you're not from there, you tend to see this as something exotic and strange and isolated. And I wonder to what extent something like Old Christmas is not seen as a carryover tradition, but what we do at Christmas.
That's right. And it was, everybody knew that it was Old Christmas. Yeah. So, you know, we did not do Old Christmas down on our end of the banks. That was the northern end, but we knew that's what they did, and we didn't question it. So, you know, you know, one of the big themes that Barbara and I kept trying to stress over and over, and in other work as well, is our connections, how much alike the 21 communities of the Scenic Byway are. And they very much are when you dig down and you go back generations and find the people who are descendants of those people who are, were fishermen and boat builders and hunters and guides and all that. So that each community had its distinctiveness, but he also had those commonalities. And Old Christmas was Rodanthe's. That was their claim to fame.
Also learned about some interesting features of life down there. I did not know about the life-saving service, which was part of the, came along at the end of the 19th century. Tell us what that was and what role it played in the Outer Banks.
Oh, that was very important. There was a spate of shipwrecks in the early 1800s, where just hundreds and hundreds of lives were lost. And so Congress eventually authorized the establishment of these life-saving stations. And, you know, they were spaced, so far apart. And over the years, more were added. And so when the life-saving stations were in full throttle, every inch of the coastline was patrolled by these surfmen, whether on horseback or foot. And, you know, they would leave one life-saving station and head down the beach and meet another surfman. And they would exchange tokens to prove that they had done their beat and then go back. But, you know, I mean, the Graveyard of Atlantic, right, earns that nickname. And it was such dangerous waters that it was extremely important to have these shores patrolled.
And you tell the story of Richard Etheridge, an interesting story.
Yes, yes. Richard Etheridge was the first African-American leader of the life-saving station at Pea Island. And the Pea Island, that was an all-African-American crew. They had some pushback when that was first established, and the life-saving station actually was burned to the ground, but then rebuilt. And Richard Etheridge's crew, you know, made some amazing rescues, including the E.S. Newman rescue, if I'm remembering that correctly, which I believe was, when was that, Karen? 1915, perhaps?
Mm-hmm. Early part of the 20th century.
Okay.
Yeah.
And they were not recognized for that rescue until 100 years later. And so, you know, after the fact, the families were awarded with the gold medal, a huge honor.
Well, tell us about the changes that have taken place on the Outer Banks. Karen, I mean, things are changing down there. How are folks perceiving that change? How do people feel about living
there? Depends on the day. Yeah. And depends on who you talk to. Just coming off of a big Memorial Day weekend, and several commented that it was the most people ever on Harker's Island. It's hard. There's a lot of changes in the landscape, a lot of changes in the economy, a lot of struggles, territorial and policy and procedures. But, you know, and again, the Hatteras Island and Ocracoke are in different places than down East Carteret County in general. Harker's Island's becoming more and more a resort community. But when you get into the real down East, Sea Level, Stacy, Davis Shore, Cedar Island, those are still very much working communities. People moving in, but when people move into those communities, they know off the bat that those are working communities, not landscaped lawns or any of that. So it's hard. It's very hard, but it's changed. It's always changed. My grandmother was born on Shackelford Banks, And she moved to Harker's Island when she was 12 years old because the tide took them. And salt water got in their wells, and the dirt turned to sand, and they had to find higher ground. So they adapted, and they moved on. So I think, Carmine Prioli, a mutual friend, talks about that whole adaptation of island people because you live with change.
Mm. So I would think then down there it just might be a little more difficult to talk about things like sea level change, climate change, because, again, if you've seen this stuff over generations where everybody's had to make adjustments to more acute kinds of changes, you know, it's probably easier to dismiss some of these other larger claims. Am I right about that?
Sea level rise has become such a political nightmare
yeah.
that it all depends on where you are, again. The signs are everywhere.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
The signs are everywhere. The landscape is changing, and it has been. And, you know, I think the difference now is our response to it. People ask me about, you know, beach renourishment, and I say, back when that was just coming of age, and I'd say, well, my grandmother moved off of Shackelford for higher ground, and she was smart enough to know that she couldn't stop the sea. And I think there's an acceptance among local people that change is real. And you work with it. You live with it. You adapt to it. You can't find enough money to stop the sea. So it's the approach to the issues, I think, is the greatest difference between the people moving in and the people who've been there for 100 years.
Barbara, what's your hope? I'll ask you both, but I'll start with you for this book. What's your intention and what's your hope?
Well, you know, we started this book. One of the things that inspired us was, you know, we have a friend that lives out on Hatteras Island, Susan West, and she used to work in the post office. And she said that, you know, one day a woman came in and said, "You mean people actually live here?" You know, there was this idea that we're at the beach, so therefore everybody here is also on vacation, right? Mm-hmm. What do you mean people are here 33 miles, you know, flung out 33 miles in the Atlantic during the winter? How can that be? There's actually schools here and people making a living. And, you know, it's not hard to miss that. If you're traveling the length of the byway or you're renting a cottage for a week, you can easily miss the extremely rich history, the extremely rich culture that is still very vibrant in these communities. So we wanted to call attention to that, and we hope that it enriches the visitor's experience to learn about the people of that area. And we hope that it enriches we hope we're making the local people proud as well.
Any sense of, well, forgive me for interrupting, but I want to ask Karen on that very point,
yeah.
how the book is doing down there, the idea, is it having that effect?
It's been a very quiet, I've been very self-conscious of it. I figure if it's good and it's right, it will rise to the top. I think people in Ocracoke and Hatteras are used to people coming and things being written about them. I think the people down east are much more protective and cautious. It was important to me that it be their voices, their book. You know, all the photography is from other people. A lot of the sidebars are things that have been written before, because to me, it's their story. I lived in it just like they did, and it's no more mine than it is theirs. So I told the folks at the press when they first asked us about it, I said, well, you got to understand, I'm not in this to write it for somebody from Ohio or New Jersey. No offense taken here or given. You know, my part of this is to make sure that when Ernie Foster at Hatteras reads it, or Alton Balance on Ocracoke, or Joel Hancock on Harker's Island, when they read it, it's right to them in their heart. And that they believe that we've captured the spirit of these communities that have shaped us.
Probably should have talked to you after the reading at the museum, but what a pleasure talking with you now to hear your story. Karen Willis Amspacker and Barbara Garrity Blake, thank you both so much for being on the program.
Thank you, Frank.
They are co-authors of Living at the Water's Edge, A Heritage Guide to the Outer Banks. They're going to be reading from the book at Quail Ridge Books in Raleigh tomorrow at 7, the Regulator Bookshop in Durham, and at the Coeur Sound Waterfall Museum and Heritage Center on June 24th, a number of other venues along the coast as well, and we'll have those at our website, stateofthings.org. Just ahead, writer Daniel Wallace talks about his new novel, Extraordinary Adventures. Stay with us.